Just by way of review, we did talk about three major documents last week, and you do have those notes in front of you, but I'm going to ask anyway, what were those three documents of British civic law that I emphasized last week? I need all three with a raised hand. Mr. Herger.
All three. I'll give you one that I see.
I need all three.
Okay. It was the Magna Carta.
That's one.
The Petition of Rights.
And
then the English Bill of Rights.
Okay, so those were the three that we went over. What was the importance of the Petition of Right? What were some of the things that it did? Again, you don't really have to scratch your head. You just have to look at the paper. So, Brandy? No taxation without Parliament, which was a huge, huge change, stripping away the king's right to tax. What else did the Petition of Right do? No imprisonment without cause. It's another big deal. We're getting the idea of legal systems. Okay, so now the king has his judicial authority stripped from him, at least in that way. What were some provisions that the English Bill of Rights made that are there on your sheet? The English Bill of Rights. It really is just kind of a magnification of the Petition of Right, but it does make some key changes as well. Yes, Megan? So monarchy can't override Parliament, changing essentially the supreme power of British government from the king to Parliament. This also has to do with the king's ability to dismiss and call Parliament. He no longer has that power. Can't just dismiss them when he gets tired of them. And then one other, and we'll get into this lesson today. Yes, ma'am. Protected freedom of speech. So now you can speak out against the king. You can speak out against Parliament. If you're a member of Parliament, you have that freedom, which is key, right? Because if Parliament, as a representative body that is made up of several different people, you have to have freedom of speech or else nothing's going to get done in Parliament, right? So that's why freedom of speech is so important in the United States, because all of our government systems within federalism, it's all representative and it's all dispersed among a lot of different people. And if those people can't talk, then what's the point? And you're obviously going to descend into something that resembles monarchy, tyranny, things like that. So the issue with taxation is multifaceted, and I don't necessarily like reading straight off of my slides, but I'll read this. And it requires the information from the last lesson to fully understand the issues. Today we'll look not only at the processes, we'll only look at the processes by which the colonies were taxed and the legal routes for taxation, and then next week, we'll study the actual taxing of colonial economic and civic activity. Now, I wrote that and then realized that I might actually get into that this week, too. So it really just depends on how much time we have and what discussion there is. But this will be one of the lessons where I think we'll have quite a bit of time for discussion and questions. And I do encourage that as we go. Okay, so if we get to the end of a slide and you want to jump in and you don't want to necessarily wait for a question and comment time, that's fine. But as always, make sure that it's on topic, or else you'll send me on a rabbit trail. Okay, so we have to look at what the British colonies actually were, because this is a source of a lot of confusion. And this is such a unique situation, because it's very difficult for us to compare the British colonies to any other colonies almost in the history of colonies. Because a lot of times what happens is you have a major power. So let's say like Persia or the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great, you have a conquering power, right? And it goes throughout the known world or throughout its territory that's close to it, and it conquers people, right? And then you have subjected people that are not necessarily from that core power that are now ruled by them, right? You've been defeated in battle. Your land now belongs to another king, and the empire therefore expands. And so you could label those subjected countries almost like colonies. And that's what happens after the American Revolution with the expansion of imperialism. You have all sorts of colonies in Africa. And a lot of those are ruled through military martial law. Those are colonies. Same thing happens in Asia. Same thing happens throughout South America and Central America with Spain and other world powers like Portugal that get involved there. Those are colonies, those are conquered people that are now under a separate nationality, a separate core country. That is not what the British colonies are. We can't think of them as anything different than British citizens, and that's what I have there for number one. It consists of British subjects that are British in both lineage and blood. There's no nationality difference. There's no race difference. There's not even much of a religious difference. Okay, both of those countries are labeled Protestant historically. The Anglican Church in England is a Protestant church. It's non-Catholic, and therefore it's Protestant. You have Protestants that are living in the British colonies. Some of them are Anglican. Some of them are Protestant. Some of them are Separatists, Baptists. You have all types of Protestants, but they are Protestant. And they see themselves as an extension of that British land. And that's apparent in a couple of different ways. Number two, they fight alongside the British as equals for a common goal and a common cause. Who is the arch rival of England throughout history? And it's only in the modern age that they're allies. France. These countries hate each other historically. And there's still, I'm sure, jokes that go all through England about how the French do such and such, and all through France about how the English are just a bunch of idiots. But during this time, they're each other's nemesis. So who fights alongside the British in North America against their arch rival, the French? The Americans, who see themselves not as Americans, but as British subjects who are fighting alongside them. Okay? Is it beneficial? Does the French and Indian War benefit England? Immensely. Canada is a French colony prior to the French and Indian War. Canada today, we all know, speaks English, except for a few pockets like Quebec and Montreal. But it's still British. It's part of the Commonwealth. The French and Indian War benefits the British exponentially, kicking out their rival completely out of the New World. France has very little land now in North America. Does it help the Americans? The American colonies, absolutely. But you can see how the Americans go, okay, we fight alongside you, we died alongside you, we fought for a common goal. We are British. We fought under the exact same flag against your enemy. Okay, so that's an important distinction. As British citizens, we're on number three now, all colonial governments are legally established under British law. They come over to the colonies and go, okay, King James or whoever was the monarch at the time the colony was, we're going to do our own thing. We're going to diverge completely from everything that British law has done. We want to completely separate from England. We want nothing to do with you. We're going to do our own thing. That's not what happens. All of the colonies that we talked about this last week, all those colonies are legally established under British law and use English common law, which is based on the Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, and the English Bill of Rights, to found their own governments as extensions of the British legal system. They're not operating outside of the British legal system. They're operating within it. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone in the colonies is a law-abiding person, but if they break the law in the colonies, they're tried just as they would be in England. A jury of peers, a court, all of those things. So there's some major changes that are made in colonial government, like the direct representation. Parliament's not direct representation. It's not a direct representative body during this time. But it is a representative body. And so the colonies set up governments that reflect all of the evolution of British law that we talked about last week. All right, so they're not operating separately in a way that would be seen as outright rebellion at all. All the colonists will profess loyalty to the King of England, and that will happen all the way up until essentially 1776 when the Declaration of Independence is signed, where the colonies, and this might be cause for debate, but the colonies are thinking this is inevitable at this point with all the things that the British are doing. We have no choice except to use force to protect ourselves. But they make very clear through the Stamp Act Congress, the First Continental Congress, all of those meetings leading up to the actual 1776 signing of the Declaration, we do not want to do this. We view ourselves as loyal to the king, and we will profess that loyalty up until the point that you make it impossible. And that is their view. Now, whether or not they're incorrect in that is something that we have to continue to study. But their view is not like when we'll study the French Revolution and compare and contrast these two, you're going to see some major differences, okay? Some huge differences. These are not at all the same. Okay? But the colonists want to stay loyal. They want to stay, they want to have a good legal standing with the British government as long as possible. So it's not just these rebellious people running around burning things and looting, destroying property, and all these awful things. Even, we're going to talk about the Boston Tea Party, that was even reimbursed. And the people that raided those ships in Boston Harbor cleaned up after themselves. Right? These are not just like, this is not BLM. Right? This is not Antifa that's just destroying things. And don't you ever let anybody tell you that there's a similarity. There is not. Okay, the Boston Tea Party, not a single person was harmed. And the only thing that was destroyed besides the tea, which was a definite message, you're going to see why they did that, the locks that were broken to get into the harbor. That's the only property that was destroyed apart from the tea. Right? So, major, major difference here. How could the colonies be taxed? Because if we talk about taxation, and we'll go through a lot of the acts that the colonies have issues with, were the colonies being taxed? Were colonists paying taxes before the French and Indian War? And this is a study that I actually had to do. I had to look into it a little bit because I wasn't sure how much they're actually already paying to the British. So they do already pay taxes. You can see that with number one. They pay duties. And did everybody get fill in the blanks for this last one? I didn't with you guys. There's some blanks there for this point, and I don't want you to miss it since you're taking notes. This is what happens in my classes too. I keep talking. The kids are like, slow down, wait. Don't have any of that written down. I go, well, write faster. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you look at people like John Adams, who was immersed into legal matters. And what you're going to find out is as this takes place in the 1770s, the American colonists begin to sway people in England that they're actually acting more legal than the king is. So you have people like William Pitt, who actually sympathize with the colonies. We'll look at that next week. And you start to wonder, okay, like how justified is a lot of this stuff that they're doing? If you have like well-educated people, well-educated colonists, educated in England, who are saying, oh yeah, this is totally correct. We're doing everything by legal standards that we can. It's very interesting. Okay, so the colonies already pay taxes. They pay duties to the British government for trade, and they pay taxes for public services in their locality. And I got that information from the Hoover Institute. The duties that they pay to the British government, it's essentially a tax that you pay for use of trade. All right, so because the American colonies are operating under the British government, there are certain taxes that they have to pay to have access to the markets that Britain provides them with. When you're dealing with colonies that are under an imperial power, a lot of times what happens is an extraction economy where the power will go in, extract all of the resources that they need, and they will simplify that colony's economy to just produce a few cash crops. Okay. So what is that colony getting out of it? the fact that that power that rules them has access to all of those markets. And so that's what England is really doing for the American colonists at the time. They're growing tons of cash crops, tobacco, grain, timber trade, fur trade, tea even that's grown. Rice is grown a lot in the South. So all these products that are grown in the colonies are for a specific purpose. Okay, they're cash crops. You're not consuming them yourself for your own sustenance. You're selling your abundance of it to make a profit. Well, if you sell everything that you can to the colonies that are in your locality, so along the eastern seaboard, where do you send all of the excess? England and all of England's trade partners. Okay, so you have to pay a duty for those trading rights. And those are being paid, yes. So in other words, paying American, no, not that I know of. Yeah, it's the act of exporting goods. But you will pay, tariffs and duties are very complicated. Because if you place a tariff on a good, like let's say Toyota, we don't want people to buy foreign cars anymore. In the United States, let's just say the government doesn't want to do that anymore. So they're going to place a tariff on Toyota vehicles so that when you go to a car lot and you go to a Toyota dealership and you want to buy a Toyota Camry, it's $50,000. But if you go to a Chevy lot and you want to buy an Impala, it's only $20,000. Which one are you going to buy? The $20,000 one, right? So you buy that. That's a tariff, but that's meant to protect market. Duties, my understanding of them anyway, is that the American colonies are paying that tax in order to get their goods traded on that market, as opposed to, so it is a tax. I mean, and it's an economic tax on a good. Okay, and what we're going to see is they pay duties on imported stuff too. So to be able to import things like tea from the British. Or the East India Trading Company, they'll be taxed on that too. No American, I'm gonna have to look at that and clarify exactly what duties are. Though no American ever enjoyed paying taxes, the belief, and with most of you will probably agree today, that you're paying for every service and privilege that they use within the government. Does it make sense that if you live in England and are ruled by your local government there, Parliament, typically, that you would pay different taxes than the American colonies would? You would think so, because you are paying for different things. If I am living in the 1760s and I want state-paved roads in Virginia, then the House of Burgesses in Virginia might pass a tax that I need to pay. Now, I don't like paying that tax because it's taking my income, but I understand that I'm using what I'm being taxed for. And this is one of the major issues I have with public schools. Are you paying for what you're using? If your kid is in a public school, should you be taxed for it? In the sense of, I am paying for my kid's enrollment. If you have no children in that school, should you be taxed for it? No, you're not using the service. So it doesn't make any sense. And when you vote for tax increases, now every homeowner in Greeley suddenly has to pay a tax so that McAuliffe can build an extension. Well, not everybody in Greeley is going to McAuliffe. So why would somebody that lives in, you know, East Greeley or somewhere outside of that district, their kid's not going to McAuliffe, why would their taxes go up? Okay? And this is that's definitely an American type of thinking. My taxes should go to something that I use. If I use food stamps, I should be taxed for it. If I don't use food stamps, I don't want to be taxed for it because I don't have access to that. I'm not using it. So once you have larger and more numerous taxes after the French and Indian War, the British government is thinking, we're in massive amounts of debt. King George III, I'm trying to think if I want to diverge here and explain about the Hanovers. Do it. Raise your hand if you want to hear about the Hanovers. Okay, great. Let's do it. So here's what happens. This is how messed up the British monarchy has become. George the First, George the Third's grandfather, is from Hanover, which is essentially Germany. You can think of it just like Germany. So they tag this guy to come over to Britain, and they're like, you're the closest relation that we can find for the king. Can you be the king? Does not speak a lick of English. He speaks German. He has no idea what's going on in his court. No idea. So imagine this. You have a German sitting on the English throne because, well, he's just the next related guy. And this is where Thomas Paine and common sense is thinking. The hereditary right of kings is completely bogus. You're just tagging whoever you can find, oh, the second cousin twice removed from this guy who was king 50 years ago because whatever royal line has died off, we're going to grab him. Is he a good ruler? We don't know. Is he from your country? Probably not. Does he know anything about his job? No. But come over here, you German-speaking George I, come over here and sit on the throne and make a bunch of decisions. Well, George II and then George III, of course, by this time, their family is a little bit more entrenched into British politics. George III likes the idea of absolute monarchy and wants to restore the power to the crown within the British government. So you do have a little bit of a... He operates outside of British law, okay, and we're going to see that soon. So you have to think about George III as somebody who's more of an absolute monarch. All that to say, absolute monarchs spend a lot of money, like a lot of money. And remember, he can't impose taxes to pay for all those expenditures without Parliament. So he's going to Parliament after his French and Indian War, saying, we're in massive amounts of debt, and I've spent a ton of money trying to build up my military. We got to pay for it. Well, where is the wealthiest part of the British Empire that's been exempt from a lot of taxes? The colonies. And so he goes to Parliament and says, we need to start passing taxes on the colonies. And this is where the divergence of British and American taxation philosophy is. The British government is expanding its power under George III, paying for more and more and more things, becoming more and more in debt, and they have to have funding for it. So whether or not you agree with the expansion of the government power is really a moot point. Who is going to impose taxes on the colonies? Parliament or the bodies that have already imposed taxes, which is, you know, their local colonial governments. So apart from the duties and the tariffs, is Parliament going to continue to start taxing? Do they have the right to tax the colonies? And this is the question. All right, so let's look at some of the taxes that take place. Actually, let's stop here because I said that I have extra, we have time, so we're going to definitely hit this today. But any comments or questions on this stuff? Or anything prior to that in this lesson?
So England was going through a power struggle, essentially, because the king wanted to reclaim everything that had been, in his opinion, lost.
I wouldn't say that there was like a lot of animosity between Parliament and King George. There wasn't a lot of tension, but there is a lot of spending taking place. And King George does want to retain as much power that he can, that Parliament will allow him. So I think what you have more so is Parliament allowing the king to do more and being okay with that, as opposed to the struggle. Like the Prime Minister, Grenville, he's not struggling with the king and trying to grab power back, to my knowledge. I'm sure there's always some tension during this time because there's still quite a bit of power with the monarchy. But Parliament is allowing this to take place. And I think that there's some sort of reward that Parliament is seeing as the British Empire continues to expand. Because are things going bad for the British? No. No.
Could you explain Parliament real quick? Because the House of Commons has some words. And it's not, I think a lot of people want to equate that to our bicameral system here. But
yeah.
It's not.
And that's because the British are obsessed with the way things look as opposed to the way things operate. In American government, we are very pragmatic. And you may go, yeah, well, that's not true. If you look at other governments around the world, it is true. If you hold a position in government, then you should be doing something. Does the Queen of England do anything? No. She's just head of state. She's a figurehead. Same thing with Parliament, actually. House of Lords, do they do anything? No. They just have the right last name, their historical nobility, and so they sit in the House of Lords. The House of Commons is where all the power is. Okay? And the House of Commons is where the elections take place. And what happens is you don't have, nobody votes for the Prime Minister in England, which is kind of odd to think about. So it's not like in the United States where you vote for a president. Nobody voted for the current Prime Minister of England. What happens is you have heads of parties, and whichever party has the majority in Parliament forms a government. And so that party then votes on who's going to be Prime Minister, much like parties in the House of Representatives vote on who's going to be Speaker of the House. Okay, so if you can think about it that way, that it does help out. The Prime Minister sets up the government, so he'll set up the government with people from his party, and they'll hold offices much like our executive office has the Department of Health and the Department of Agriculture and, you know, the presidential cabinet. Now, the main difference is that you can have a vote of no confidence in Parliament, and it will prompt new elections. So you get some elections. My understanding is that you get some elections that are scheduled, but most of the elections happen when a prime minister steps down or there's a vote of no confidence, and then you have an election that's scheduled. So it's not like a specific date necessarily. Yes. And then Mr. Pierce. Yes. Correct. Correct. And the parliamentary system of government worldwide, I believe, is the most popular or one of the most popular. And please don't ask me to explain Canadian government because it is the biggest headache ever. And I don't even know how Canadians understand their own government. Like, you're a commonwealth, but you're under the Queen, but the Queen doesn't have any power. How does that work? Yes.
Isn't William Wilberforce quite a force during this time? Have you heard of him?
So William Wilberforce is the person who's responsible for banning slavery in England. Yeah, not the British colonies, in England. So important distinction there. And I believe it's after this. Because he might be in Parliament, but he's not starting his move because I believe it's early 1800s. And he ends the slave trade in England. So it's not that slavery is becoming illegal, it's that slave trade. And the United States does it a year after. So I think it's 1803 and 1804. But yeah, so this would be like 30 years before that. And I don't think, he is a very young representative. And he actually dies pretty young, too. So I don't think he'd be on the scene yet as I'm thinking about it. But that's a good question. Okay, let's go over these taxes here. So the first tax is actually not a tax that is passed. It's a tax that begins to be enforced. And this is one point that I think you can probably side with the British and still celebrate the 4th of July next month, okay? Because you have these sugar and molasses duties that have to be paid by American merchants that up to this point have been loosely enforced. And a lot of times the government will loosely enforce something to encourage economic growth. So if I was president of the United States, I could, through executive order, choose to enforce loosely or strictly laws that are already on the books. That's the job of the executive branch, executing the laws. There are certain laws that I would choose not to enforce because I disagree with the laws, right? And that's my prerogative as the executor of the law to say, within these boundaries, if you break this law, the punishment's not going to be very severe. And most of it would probably have to do with a lot of this economic stuff. So if you get interstate commerce that's ruled by legislation and somebody breaks that law, You go, and we're not going to penalize him with jail time. We'll just fine him, let him go. It's going to be loosely enforced. That's what's happening with these sugar and molasses duties. So American merchants are paying them sometimes, but not really a lot, and the British know that. So you go, well, those smugglers and people that are shirking, they're not. They're not. It's an agreement. It's known that this is taking place. Well, one of the ways in which the prime minister believes that he can increase income is by beginning to enforce these duties. Well, if you're an American merchant who's used to not paying those, that cuts into your profits. And so, legally speaking, do they have a right to do that? Yeah, it's a duty that you're already supposed to be paying, you just haven't been. And so if you get upset about it, get over it. The duty is lower than it would have been if they enforced it on the books. I have a note there. But the law is now strictly enforced, or at least more strictly enforced. You get a lot of merchants that are upset about it, and there's grumblings about it. But I think the general consensus is it's 1763. You're still 13 years before anybody is signing the Declaration of Independence or any rumors of any sort of, you know, it's just like, oh, man, we got to pay this tax. Don't want to do that. All right, but that's one way. This is the beginning. The Currency Act is the beginning of acts passed by Parliament that are really going to begin to upset the Americans. The Americans have a lot of debts to British bankers, etc. Right, so if you want to get a loan, most of the time you're going to go to England to get that loan and their banking system, because in the British colonies, there's not going to be a lot of American colonial banks. Currency is a tricky thing to get into, but there's no one currency in the colonies. And so you have some colonies that are using the Spanish piece of eight, which actually becomes our dollar. You have some colonies that are using the British sterling method of payment, so the pound, etc. You have some colonies that are printing their own money. And the value of that money is kind of up in the air, but they've been given the right to do that, to set a price for whatever currency they decide to mint. Issue is that along the eastern seaboard, there's no large coal or silver or gold deposits, so the actual minting of valued currency of the time is severely limited. So you get paper currency, and is Rhode Island going to accept currency from Virginia, and is New York going to accept currency from Georgia? And this is where you have kind of this back and forth. But to pay their debts to British bankers, they have to have the right to have a way to have currency, right? There has to be a way to express the value of their trading that's taking place. And the Currency Act forbids colonial governments from printing their own currency, which severely limits the ability of the American debtors to pay their debts. And it does decrease economic activity in the colonies. It has to, right? Because if you can't print your own currency, what are you going to use? The barter system? It's not going to work out. So this is going to really make the colonists very upset. And then immediately afterwards, you have the stamp tax. And this is very hated by the colonists. You have to have a government stamp on all legal documents and a lot of other paper goods like newspapers and letters, etc. So why would you impose something like this in the colonies that are operating essentially without any issue at all from a government standpoint? You're going to impose a government stamp. It is strictly a money grab. There's no reason for it. There's no real records that are being kept as a result of it. It's simply just, if you're going to sign a legal document, you're going to go to a lawyer and have a will, you have to have this stamp on it from the British government saying that it's a legal document. And as somebody who is very anti-government intervention, look at that and go, that's completely useless. There's no point of that. Hey, imagine if I'm privately selling a vehicle to somebody else, and I have to go to some legal house. Man, the liberals would love this, wouldn't they? I have to go to like the city hall and have somebody there to stamp it and say, oh yes, your bill of sale is valid. No, I'm an adult. The person buying my vehicle is an adult. We can reasonably come to an agreement and sign a contract between ourselves without having a stamp on it that says it's official. And I think that this is where we kind of get lost into, oh, the government authority is so important. There's so many things we can do on our own. There's so many things. And I'm thankful that in the United States, we still have the power to sign our name to something without having a notary or without having a government stamp on it. Because what that's saying is that it's a responsibility of the seller and the buyer or whatever party is signing that document to know and read what it is that they're signing, as opposed to the government now becoming responsible for, here's the stamp. So this is a money grab, and it's completely useless. It is repealed because the Americans are like, fine, if you're going to do this, then we're going to boycott all the British goods that are sent here. And these are a lot of manufactured goods. Okay, Britain is going through the first industrial revolution. They have tons of manufacturing plants, and the colonies provide a ton of raw materials. So those raw materials are sent to the sent to Britain, where they're manufacturing a bunch of different stuff. The best example is cotton that's grown in the South, shipped over, made into clothes, shipped back to the colonies, and they buy the clothes. What happens if the colonies go, I'm not going to buy any new clothes this year because I don't agree with the stamp tax? Well, then all those manufacturing plants get hurt, right? And on down the line, you're going to have, because their economies are so tight knit, eventually it would hurt the American colonies. But at this point, they're saying it's worth it if we can send a message. So eventually it is repealed. And everything is quelled. Essentially, any sort of unrest, they repeal the stamp tax, and the colonies are like, great, mission accomplished. The stamp tax Congress is, what's the opposite of convened? Dismissed, I guess. Isn't there like unconvened? I was thinking that there was a negative version of convened, unconvened, inconvened. I don't know. Dissolved. There, that's a good one. It was dissolved. It's not needed anymore. Then we get the Townshend Acts in 1767, and this is going to impose the duties, so essentially tariffs is what we're dealing with, on British China, glass, lead, paint, paper, and tea, important thing here, imported to the colonies. So all of these goods that are bought very frequently and that are necessities in the American colonies for the growth of continued growth of their economy, now they have to pay higher taxes on that stuff. And the British know that those are going to be the most purchased goods from their empire by the American colonies, so there's really no way around not paying that tax. And if the price is set on British goods, then there's no way for the Americans to avoid the tax, right? So it's not like the duties that they're avoiding on molasses and sugar trade, where they just simply don't have to pay them to have access to the market. Now, they have to pay those duties because it's more like a tariff. Okay. The important distinction here with the Townshend Acts is that it also gives a tax-free monopoly on tea trade to the British East India Trading Company. So on the surface, that sounds really bad. But if you dig deeper, it gets even worse because tea is grown in the United States. And it's a big cash crop for a lot of southern plantations that are growing it. If you give a tax-free monopoly, so East India Trading Company doesn't have to pay any taxes to the British government, who's going to dictate all of the trade for the tea? It's going to be that company, the British East India Trading Company. And there's no way for the American tea growers and merchants to compete. They can't compete with those prices. And so their tea is not going to be purchased on the world market, or will it be even purchased in the colonies? Because the price for tea is going to, you know, be something that they can't compete with, because they do have to pay the taxes. The other thing that I want to point out here is that, and we have to wrap up here, when we start talking about monopolies and anti-monopoly laws that are on the books in the United States, watch out. That is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because the only monopolies that come about in a free market economy are monopolies that are granted by the government. The free market does not create monopolies. Okay? And that is an important thing. There's probably people in this room that might debate me on that point, but I would like to have a discussion with you about it. Because a truly free market economy, laissez-faire, not strictly regulated by the government, does not create monopolies. You go, what about Standard Oil and Rockefeller? What about who's the railroad magnate? I forget his name now. Talk to me. Because how is it that under those monopolies that were created under the free market, prices for consumers fell to the lowest point they'd ever been? Waste was reduced. Those companies were highly efficient. There was nothing better for the American consumer than for Standard Oil to continue to exist. And after Standard Oil was broken up because it was a monopoly and it wasn't allowing competition, what happened to prices for consumers? Skyrocketed. Okay? And who was it that was going to the government during that time to tell them to pass anti-monopoly laws? It was Standard Oil, it was Rockefeller's competitors that had their hands in the pockets of congressmen because they could not compete with Rockefeller's prices on the free market. That's why we have anti-monopoly. And this is a great example of that. Monopolies are granted by governments. Monopolies are not created in a free market. Okay. So I'm sure we could, you know, continue this conversation long. This is almost completely, you know, divergent conversation, but this is a, you know, as far as economics goes, this is a major point and one that I try to drive home to my students when we study the robber barons or the robber baron myth of American history. Free market is not responsible for monopolies. The free market will always go to whoever has the best product for the best price. Okay, let's end there, and we'll talk about the Boston Tea Party next week. Heavenly Father, we thank you for...